Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. Author and poet David White says that there are three key commitments in our lives: to our significant others, to our work, and to ourselves. Too often, he says, we concentrate on one or two and neglect the others. But each of those, he says, is vitally important, and to ignore any of them is to impoverish them all. This morning, in this hour of the show, we'll be talking about how we can try to bring these parts of our lives together, and it is the subject of David White's recent book, The Three Marriages, the subtitle Reimagining Work, Self, and Relationship. Riverhead is the publisher of the book. One reason that we're talking about this morning with him is so that we can also have the opportunity to mention that he will be visiting the campus of the University of Illinois. This will be next month. On March 19th, he'll be giving a talk at the Alumni Center, 5 o'clock in the afternoon. His visit here is sponsored by the College of Engineering in connection with an initiative to support work-life balance. So I'm sure they'll be talking about some of the things that you can find in the book. In the meantime, of course, if you're interested, you can go to the bookstore and look at the book, or you can look at his website if you'd like to find out more about him and his work. His last name is spelled W-H-Y. T-E, by the way, davidwhite.com. Just a little bit more about him. He grew up in Yorkshire. He now makes his home with his family in the Pacific Northwest. He is the author of a number of books, 7 volumes of poetry, as well as the bestsellers The Heart Aroused, Poetry and the Preservation of the Soul in Corporate America, and Crossing the Unknown Sea, Work as a Pilgrimage of Identity. He is internationally known as a speaker and consultant. He's been commissioned to speak for Fortune 500 companies such as American Express, Boeing, and Toyota. He is Associate Fellow of Templeton College, Oxford University. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions, comments certainly are welcome if you'd like to call in and talk with the guest or comment on the subject of the conversation. That is certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one, good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you'd like to join the conversation, we certainly welcome that. We only ask people to try and be brief so we can keep moving along. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Mr. White, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Yes.
We appreciate it. Just with initial apologies here to the folks who are interested in this initiative on supporting work-life balance, one of the things that you actually mention in the book is that you prefer not to use those words,
exactly.
For a variety of reasons, and maybe we could start there.
Yes, I've worked as a poet inside organizations for years, and using memorized poetry to get into areas you can't normally speak about. Mm-hmm. And I've always noticed that whenever the phrase work-life balance was used, that there was a kind of fog came into the room, that it wasn't clear. And people would feel it was intuitively that the phrase was inaccurate, that you couldn't choose between work and life, and that they were often intertwined. And so I just found myself in a talk one day, it was actually in Johannesburg in South Africa, stumbling into this theme, and suddenly I overheard myself talking about these three marriages that we were all involved with, and the marriage with another person, a significant other, marriage with your vocation and work, and the marriage with yourself. And as soon as I said it, I said to myself, that's much more accurate. Mm-hmm. And in actual fact, there are three non-negotiable marriages, and you can only actually put them in conversation with one another. If you try to balance them out, it just has you working harder in all three areas. So you work all the hours God sends at work, then you rush home, do the chores, talk with your spouse, and then you say to yourself, oh, I must get my jogging gear on and run around the block too to keep my health together. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about work-life balance, you're turning life into this logistical necessity, which just has you exhausted at the end of it. And I'm looking at a way of holding the conversation where you can put all three together in a much more restful and more fruitful way.
Yeah. It seems that the other metaphor that people use all the time to describe how it is that they're trying to do all these things, to give attention to all those areas of their life, the other metaphor that people seem to like to use a lot is juggling.
Yes, and that's just working at the periphery. And what you're missing is the fiery kind of chemistry that's there in each of the commitments. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're just... we all know the way that in our marriages at home or our commitments at home, an initial romantic love relationship can just be turned into, you can become as a couple just a logistical army of two, getting the kids here, getting that there, getting that paid, and you lose the initial chemistry that brought you together. We all know the way that in a work, you can suddenly find yourself just paying the bills through it and going through the motions. And we all know how we can become strangers to ourselves. So I'm looking at the way that in each of those three marriages, you have to keep this alchemical, elemental, central conversation alive, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to... one of the things, actually, that looking at another person through the perspective of the three marriages allows you is, for your spouse, you know, I can look at my wife and I can say, actually, she's not just involved in this one marriage with me. She actually has these two other marriages, too. She's married to her vocation and to herself. And actually, they're just as important as this marriage. As soon as I do that, I have a much more generous relationship with that other person.
Yeah.
And I stop thinking that they were placed on this planet just to make me happy, which I think is gives you a good start, you know, yeah, on a proper relationship with another person.
I'm sure that when people, obviously, when people hear the term marriage, what they're going to think of is, in the first sense that you use, sort of the most conventional, more conventional sense that has to do with your bond with another person, with your partner. Maybe you could talk a little bit more. I'm interested in how it is you feel that metaphor does extend nicely to these other kinds of relations. That is, one's relationship to one's work and also to one's inner self.
Yes, very good question. And I'm looking really at the marriages in the sense of both the courtship that occurs before a commitment and all the vicissitudes and difficulties you go through once you've actually made the commitment. So, for instance, I follow all these lives in the book. I follow the life of Jane Austen. I follow the life of Robert Louis Stevenson and the woman he fell in love with, Fanny Osborne, and various other people. And I look at the way that the way you fall in love with another person has an exact parallel with the way that you fall in love with a work or vocation. For instance, when I was 14 years old, I walked into our living room in the north of England and saw Jacques Cousteau sailing across our little television set. And I fell in love with the possibility of doing that work myself, literally standing there with my mouth open. Until that moment, I didn't believe it was possible for anyone to have a job which could be so exciting and so adventurous. And I fell in love in such a profound way that I gave up all of my art subjects, which were natural to me, and put myself into the salt mines of biology, chemistry, and physics, and went through some very difficult territory, because it was much harder for me to do sciences than arts. But I did eventually emerge with a degree in marine zoology and then lived for 2 years in the Galapagos Islands, which you could say was the kind of engagement and commitment with the love relationship that had first started in my teens, and lived out many of the qualities that I first hungered for when I saw Jacques Cousteau on that little television set.
Maybe just very quickly, I should introduce again our guest, David White. He grew up in Yorkshire in the UK, now lives in the United States. He is a poet, has published 7 books of poetry, as well as the book The Heart Aroused, Poetry and the Preservation of the Soul in Corporate America. He does a lot of speaking to large corporate gatherings, and he will be here next month on the 19th of March here on the campus of the University of Illinois. The folks in the College of Engineering are bringing him. In the meantime, if you're interested in reading some more on this subject, you can look for his book, The Three Marriages, Reimagining Work, Self, and Relationship. It's published by Riverhead. You should be able now to find it in the bookstores. You'd want to find out more about him and who he is, perhaps read some of his writing. You can also go to his website, davidwhite.com. Questions welcome, 333-9455, and toll-free 800-222-9455. Just for a second, I suppose this is continuing to talk about work. I'm just very interested in how someone with the varied background that you have and your interest in writing and poetry particularly ends up working in the organizational field and working with people in these very large companies. It seems, I know that there are, you know, various people who do that and who try to help people in their work lives think about what they're doing and how they're doing it and how the organization works and how people relate to one another. But someone who comes from your background, particularly as a poet and writer, that seems kind of unusual to me.
Yes, and it's one of the surprises that I've had in that second marriage with my vocation as a poet. You know, I talked about how I went into sciences when I was 14, but I'd written poetry since I was quite small with the influence of my Irish mother. I returned again to, once I'd lived in the Galapagos Islands, I had no more ambitions in marine zoology. I'd done everything I wanted to do. And so I returned to poetry, actually, as my primary vocation. And I never went into poetry imagining that I would work in the organizational world. I just, once I started speaking in public and drawing on memorized poetry, you know, to get into areas you can't normally get into, I started to get unsolicited invitations to come into various organizations. And I suppose work with the conversational nature of leadership. And so it was just a natural door that opened up. And I was very wary at the beginning because I was very wary of having to compromise my work as a poet. And I certainly wasn't interested in using poetry for any kind of managerial spin. But I was quite astonished, actually, to find that not only did I not have to compromise poetry and the poets that stood behind me, you could say, but actually people were pushing me to be braver and to elucidate more of the qualities that poetry has always emboldened people to look at. And so, you know, in the work world, there's an immense amount of inherited language, which is quite weak language. And the whole work world has moved into the field of human relationship in such an enormous way that the inherited language in that world is not large enough for the world that everyone has to deal with on a daily basis. And so I'm bringing a kind of language which is large enough for the human dynamics that people are working with as they sit in their office cubicles or BlackBerry or sit in the meeting room working with all those other strange creatures called human beings.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine that either that people might have one or two reactions. Either they might think that this was very strange that you would be speaking to them, or I suppose the thing that you would hope for is they might find this very refreshing and say, "Ha! Now this is really very different, and maybe there's something here for me." It perhaps can catch their attention in a way that someone who was a more straightforward kind of business-oriented motivational speaker wouldn't be able to do.
Yes, and there's a kind of integrity to the poetry. It refuses to get you worked up in a rah-rah kind of way. You know, I don't like the word motivational speaker, and I run 100 miles from it myself because the whole, you know, one of the senses you get from motivational speaking is you're going to be manipulated into a certain state of being that's not natural to you. And what poetry is constantly saying is what's the makeup of your own elemental conversation with life? Will you have faith in it? And will you do the courageous thing, which is the next step from where you're standing now, no matter how humble that is? And so poetry is constantly having you look at the seasonality of your life. What's about to ripen? What's about to happen? Sometimes, actually, that seasonality has to do with a kind of disappearance where you have to actually subvert your reality on the outside in order to move on. You know, if you've been very successful at a particular career, but you feel imprisoned by it, you might actually have to work against your success in order to get out of it. You might have to actually, sometimes people actually, you see it, actually see people subconsciously sabotaging themselves to escape from a career and sometimes to escape from a marriage.
You know, thinking about my job, I think it, depending upon my mood, if you ask me what I thought about it,
yeah.
There were some times when I could just gush with all of the great things about it.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, again, if you ask me on the right day, I would tell you that I was just crushed by it. And I'm
yeah.
someone who is lucky in the sense that I have a job that gives me some freedom
yeah.
and some opportunity to be creative. It's not I'm sure other people have jobs that are much less
yeah.
satisfying. But having said all that, I guess I think about how it is that you try. At least I try, and people try to remind me of all of the positive things, you know, even if you feel that it's sometimes in an unhealthy way the center of your life, how it is that you continue to remind yourself of all of those things about it that are really very good.
Yes. And it's interesting, this dynamic is in all three marriages because, of course, you know, in your marriage at home or your relationship at home, there's lots of good things, but also there are ways in which you often feel you can feel just as equally and in parallel suffocated and held in by your marriage, and you can feel it also with your relationship with yourself. And what I'm looking at in the book actually is the way that this is a normal, natural part of each of the three commitments, and that you're not meant to turn your face away from these vulnerabilities and just focus on the positive part. Those vulnerabilities actually tell you a lot about the way you're made and what you're afraid of in life, but also the very doors you have to walk through. You know, if you look, for instance, in a love relationship, in a marriage at home, all of the real conversations occur through vulnerability. You can't have an annual peer review with your spouse or your wife. It doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a certain kind of vulnerable inquiry with your spouse, where you admit to a few things and they admit to a few things and you both go in parallel. And it's the ability to actually know where your writ does not run, you know, where you don't have competence, where you're in relationship to the unknown, where all the rich material is and where the marriage actually moves along. And in many ways, there's an equal parallel in your relationship to your vocation and your work, that there's a part of you that's living in your work that knows how it all works and you know how to play the game, you know, to be successful. There's another part of you which is constantly looking to the way that it's changing into something else, and that if you stay too tightly in that circle you've made for yourself, you'll become imprisoned by it and you'll feel as if life is passing you by. So there's a way in which in the marriage at home, in the marriage with our work, and in the marriage with ourselves, you've got to give each of the marriages away continually to see how they come back to you.
Mm.
You know, in your 20s, you have a different relationship to your work than you do in your 30s. In your 40s, you have a different relationship to your work than you did in your 30s. You want something different from it. You want it to serve different things. You want to work in a different way. And you've constantly to be finding out who's there, how you want to do your work, and what work you want to do. And that's how you keep it alive. So it's this conversational frontier in each of the marriages, which is it's necessary to stay on.
You know, and I think that points, though, it's something that's difficult. I think it's important, but that's a real challenge, and that is to understand how over time you and these other things change. And I'm sure that there are many places where things seem to be going along just fine, or at least they go along. And then one day in your marriage, maybe one day you wake up and you look at that other person and you realize, this is not the person that I married. And you ask yourself, when did that happen? And I'm sure
yeah.
that the same thing can happen in your work. You're going along, you're sort of doing the
yeah.
same thing. You've been doing it for a long time. And then suddenly one day you think something, it's not the way that it was. Something changed, or maybe change is forced on you. And suddenly you realize, when did that happen? And I think that's it seems that it's difficult not to be taken by surprise by those kinds of changes.
Yes, and in a way we'll always be taken by surprise because whatever change we're moving into, there's never any enunciation of all the details that are going to occur. You know, when you're stood at the altar with your spouse, she doesn't turn to you and say, oh, by the way, in 3 or 4 years I'm going to go through this mind-bending psychological change where I won't even recognize myself, never mind you recognize me. Oh, and by the way, if we have a child, you're moving firmly into position number two. Are you all right with that? They don't turn to you and ask you that, but that just starts to happen. So in every marriage, and in every work and in every relationship to yourself, you're going to be surprised. The great discipline, to my mind, and the poetic tradition certainly corroborates this, the great discipline is to keep up as close as you can with the trajectory of the transformation in each of the marriages. It's when you become a stranger to your partner that you suddenly wake up one day and realize that you're so distant from them, you don't even know who they are anymore. It's when you're just putting in the hours at work that you suddenly realize you're imprisoned by it, you know, a year or two later. And it's where you've spent no time in silence with yourself, getting to know who's there at each threshold on your life, that you become a stranger to yourself. So what I'm looking at is this kind of alchemical journey in each of the marriages. And the idea is to make a marriage of marriages, to put them all in conversation with one another and have them nourish and embolden one another.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is David White, and if you go looking for his book or you want to look at his website, keep in mind that his last name is spelled W-H-Y-T-E, David White. Right now we're talking about some of what you will find in his recent book, The Three Marriages, Reimagining Work, Self, and Relationship, and in which he makes this argument that there are these three key commitments in our life, and marriages is the metaphor, the word that he uses to describe them, these three key commitments in life to our partners, to our work, and to ourselves. He says, too often we end up concentrating on maybe one of them or maybe two of them and neglecting the others. All of them important, however, he says, and if you ignore any of them, all of them will suffer. I also do want to mention again that for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, he will be visiting the campus of the University of Illinois in March, sponsored by the College of Engineering. He'll be giving a talk at the Alumni Center at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on March 19th. And I believe that this will be for free and open to the public, and anybody who was interested in attending to hear him speak can do that. So mark that down, March 19th, 5 in the afternoon. Otherwise, if you're interested in finding out more about him, you can go to his website, davidwhite.com, or you can go to the bookstore or the library and look for his book, The Three Marriages. And questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have several callers here who'd like to join in the conversation. We'll start with someone in Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that I've been looking forward to this pretty much since I heard about this on Friday. It definitely kind of correlates with a lot of the ways that I kind of look at my own life about trying to balance out how I spend my time. One thing, though, that really caught me about this is that I've always been concerned with balance, but never have I felt balanced. I've always tried to balance things within myself, and then when you suggested there are other spheres that we have to consider and bring into our lives, I just had this kind of forehead-slapping moment, like, well, that's glaringly obvious. Of course, I've been...
Very good.
Missing that, because I've been trying to balance myself, but I always felt like if I came from myself in a positive and harmonious way, then everything else would just kind of fall in line. But the effort that I put into trying to make myself a better person, you know, how does that consider my wife? How does that consider my job? How does that consider how I spend my time trying to balance out my own life concerns? I'm very interested in reading your book, and I am considering coming to the lecture because I've this is something that I've been chasing for 20 years. I remember when I was 13 years old and read Ralph Waldo Emerson for the first time, his essay about circles, and then when a few years later when I read Tao Te Ching for the first time, a wonderful, by the way, poetic translation that opened up another kind of window, and I felt like I've tried to reinvent myself several times through life, and I've found myself painted in corners and had to reject a path that had a lot of success, but not very much satisfaction. And
yes, and I think the whole, you know, the whole attempt to create this balance, which is a kind of stasis, you know, it's an attempt to create a kind of unobtainable perfection, which actually holds us back from the more dynamic conversational nature of life. So there's never ever going to be a state where you have it all in balance. The great question is, do you have them in conversation with one another?
Mm.
And that's what's healing, and that's what's dynamic, and that's what's alchemical, and that's what's nourishing to human beings. Do I have any relationship at all between my goals in my vocation, my work, and my goals with my spouse? You know, are they two different spheres that don't cross? And have I made them strangers to one another because of that?
Yeah, and then it kind of, I just wanted to have a small conversation saying I'm really interested in this, but I do have something of a question. Coming from a poet's standpoint, and you've moved into a way that poetry is a part of your life.
Yes.
For me, I remember in college having a fairly, I don't know, a life that I didn't feel like was very fulfilling growing up, and then I got to college, and I accidentally took an art class, and I felt like I had a whole new language that I could speak with. I had nothing to do with words. And the difficulty has been in my life trying to incorporate arts into my life.
Yes.
And I've just entered teaching, and I absolutely enjoy opening up people's minds, saying, let's teach math with arts. Let's explore various subject matter through the arts. And I really appreciate that you have you talked about Cousteau and zoology, and how, you know, you've come this circle from, you know, poetry to science and back to poetry, and then educating and motivating people. Sorry, I used the M word. So,
yes,
I'm very interested, and I'm curious about your thoughts on balancing what's kind of considered in most of American culture frivolous activities of pursuing the arts, and the more, I don't know, honorable and mundane day-to-day, how to live my life, and then I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Well, first of all, I'd say, you know, the premise of the book is that the word balance is not only not accurate, it's not useful, and it's also a very tedious word. And so we're not trying to balance. We're trying to create an incredible live conversational dynamic between the two that emboldens and elucidates both sides. And when you get absolute balance, you get absolute stasis. So there are times when things are in balance, but they're just transitional points, you know. So I felt that this metaphor of the three marriages is much more accurate and much closer to what human beings actually experience in life. So, and particularly the difficult marriage with the self. And actually, that was the stream in the book, the marriage in the book, that was the most difficult to write about, the most elusive. How do you get to know yourself on a deeper level, just as you attempt to get to know your spouse or your work on a deeper level?
Let's go on. Let's go out and talk with someone in Clay City on our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Hello. Hello. My name is Gary Burt. I work in I'm in a transition time right now. I'm approaching retirement, and my wife is already retired. She's been a school teacher for a number of years.
Yes.
And I find that this is a very difficult time for me because I'm transitioning from a full-time job, going off to work and coming home.
Yeah.
My wife seems to be handling it quite well. She travels a lot, and I try to support her in that. I want her to get out and go and have a good time because she was tied down for many years. You know, always had to be around doing things. And I also have a hobby. I'm a professional. I sing in St. Louis at a little Italian restaurant.
Mm.
It's a passion. It's poetry set to music, and I just dearly love it. But I find myself having a hard time balancing all three things. I still work. I go to St. Louis every weekend and sing at this little restaurant, and I dearly love it. It's a passion. And yet I love my wife, and here I find myself spending less and less time with her.
Yes.
Yeah, it can be, how do you strike a balance? I mean, what am I being selfish? I mean, did I work all my life to have this time to myself to do a pet, to pursue a passion when I retire? Where do I find a balance here between staying with my wife and having a loving relationship, travel, which I love to do, which sometimes I don't like to do with other people. Sometimes I like to be by myself. I find that sometimes that all three come into sharp contrast, and especially I find the whole idea of just sitting down and doing nothing, retiring, just scares me to death. You know.
Yes.
There is.
I mean, that is one underlying dynamic, and it's very powerful in North American culture. And coming from Europe and I've lived here for over 20 years. But I think the latter half of life is very difficult for North American males, especially. Because so much of the identity is subsumed into work that it becomes it can become your whole identity. So even the intimation that you could have a much broader horizon, but you don't know what that horizon is, even the sense that this central identity actually might not be everything you are, can be quite disturbing. But I would just treat it as part of the ground that you're walking through. And, of course, it's linked also, as we get older in life, to the understanding and sure knowledge that we're actually going to die. You know, when you're 21, you know someone's going to die, but it's someone you're going to become. When you're 51, you realize you are going to die. And there's a sneaking suspicion that the rest of creation could be quite relieved to see you go also. So all of these things are together. So you're not just working with this balancing. You're actually working with your own whole mortality. You're working with letting go of this previous fixed identity into a much more conversational mode. And I'd say one of the things you can do is just sit down with your wife, actually, and talk with her about it. And that conversation will work, especially if you work with the vulnerabilities you feel, for instance, that you're not seeing her anymore. I mean, one of the things that happens for men in later life is their whole feeling world starts to open up. But it's happening just as women go through menopause and they're getting really practical and focused in their life. And so we have this strange inversion, you know, where men are starting to understand the whole vulnerable feeling nature of relationship, and almost always at the same time their spouses or their partners are starting to get focused and going out in the world. So you get this incredible reversal. So I'd treat yourself quite well about it, because there's a lot going on, and I think if you sit down and really work talk with your wife about how you're feeling this new kind of vulnerability, all kinds of things can open up, which you might not have imagined if you felt you just had to sort it all out yourself.
Well, thank you. Appreciate you answering
the question. Yes, thanks for
that. All right, thank you. Well, let's go on here. We'll talk next with someone in Champaign, and this is a caller, line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Hi, you were talking about, I write poetry myself, and I've been memorizing poems lately.
Very good.
On the advice of a poet, and you talked about using memorization as a way to get at things you can't get at ordinarily, and that was part of what got you into working with corporations and such. I would like to hear anything you could say about that. I do feel there's a power in it, but I haven't really tried very much to elucidate exactly what that is.
Well, my Irish ancestors, you know, my mother's people, would say that, you know, the power in poetry is because it's an art form which is not about a subject. It is the subject itself, you know. It is the quality itself. And so if you can memorize and literally get by heart a powerful line or two, then when you speak it into the world, you know, and if you've got it in your whole mind and heart and body, then you're actually recreating that experience in that moment, actually, and it's open to you and a possibility for you. So, for instance, if you take two lines from Wordsworth where he's committing to his future vocation as a poet, and he has these beautiful lines. He's on the mountains in the northwest of England, in Cumbria, 1798, and he says at that moment, he's looking out on this gorgeous landscape at dawn, and he says, at that moment, he said, I made no vows, but vows were then made for me. I made no vows, but vows were then made for me. Bond unknown to me was given, that I should be, else sinning greatly, a dedicated spirit, and on I walked in blessedness, which even yet remains. So that actually is a beautifully precise evocation of what occurs to a person when they're in a moment of absolute dedication, that it's not just their vows that they're making. You actually feel as if the world is making vows on your behalf, as if it's recognized your place in the conversation. Mm-hmm. This is a very ancient dynamic in many of our great religious traditions.
Yeah.
That, you know, a real vocation is never just what you want for yourself, nor is it what the world wants, but it's a conversation between your desires and your society and creation's desires for you. And so you live at this conversational edge between what you want for yourself and what the world demands of you. And that's where all the real stuff happens. So I'd say, you know, that's my approach to memorize poetry, is to actually recreate these frontiers of experience that all human beings have, but have difficulty in recalling and elucidating.
You talk about conversations. I wonder any objective examples you can talk about would be helpful. Are you saying that these worlds, these marriages overlap? Like, you know, I teach Spanish too. I bring poetry into my Spanish class. Is that kind of what you're talking about? If I write a poem about my wife or my child?
Well, it's not just as logistical as that. You know, it's happening on a more profound level. So, I would say bringing poetry into Spanish, and of course, you know, Antonio Machado and Neruda and all these. So you can have a Spanish lesson in which you're actually looking at some of the at some of these incredible human thresholds. So suddenly, it's not just Spanish; it's the view you have on life when you speak Spanish. And of course, we all understand that when you speak a different language, you actually look at the world in a different way.
Yeah.
So yes, that would bring. I'd say that would bring those two things together. But always, I'd say try and get to the leverage, you know, the crux at the center of it, rather than just trying to put them together in a logistical way. Does that make sense?
Something to reflect on, definitely.
Yeah.
Could you also, I have a request, if you could recite a poem. You explain yourself very well narratively, but I would like to hear if you've written any poems on this subject that you're talking about, if you could cite one or...
Well, perhaps... We just heard a little bit of Wordsworth.
Mm-hmm.
This is the beginning of a poem of mine called The True Love. And I wrote it for my wife, actually, when I realized I needed to commit and propose to her. But it's also about the moment you commit and propose to, in a sense, to your work. And also when you commit to a deeper understanding of yourself. So the first lines are, there's a faith in loving fiercely the one who is rightfully yours. There's a faith in loving fiercely the work that is rightfully yours. There's a faith in loving fiercely the life that is rightfully yours. There's a faith in loving fiercely the one who is rightfully yours, especially if you have waited years, and especially if you never believed you could deserve this loved and beckoning hand held out to you this way. So that would be the kind of conversational invitation that I would be looking for in each of those three marriages.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is David White. He's author, poet, grew up in Britain, now makes his home in the United States. He's the author of 6 books of poetry and 2 best-selling prose books, and he brings his work as a poet and a writer into the corporate arena, one of the few to do that kind of work. He is internationally known as a speaker and consultant, been commissioned to speak to a number of large companies like American Express, Boeing, Toyota. He's an associate fellow of Templeton College, Oxford University. His book that deals with this subject we're talking about here this morning, the title of that book is The Three Marriages, Reimagining Work, Self, and Relationship, published by Riverhead Books. And as I mentioned a couple of times, he will be on the campus of the University of Illinois. He'll be giving a talk on March 19th and open to anybody who would like to attend. So we mark that one down on your calendar. We'll continue here to talk with listeners who are interested, and we'll talk with someone in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Oh, you're talking about marriages of 3 marriages. Some people, I do a lot of environmental work, and I constantly run into people who have 23 marriages or 30 marriages. They're across the field. My question of you is, where do you find the font of energy for this sort of thing in the university? The balance between the purists, which we really need, and the generalists who need to pull things together,
yeah,
seems to be totally out of whack. I have people who don't do university studies, don't do PhDs, because the fields are too specialized.
Yes.
How do you encourage great universities like the University of Illinois to have interdisciplinary studies that allow people to think in many different directions and to have the liberality to change, as you're suggesting, in midstream because you find new and different information? I find it very, very disappointing to not have that sort of facility in a major university. It exists. It exists in interdisciplinary studies and things like that. It exists in topics like geography, agriculture, which bridge many fields. But there seems to need to be a philosophical base,
yeah,
for people to not only studies, but to come in and teach. I find in the university outside people who have such knowledge that you would want them to be teaching the teachers of teachers.
Yeah.
And there's no facility for those people. And I wonder what you would say about that.
Well, I'd say that, one of the ways we start to address it is by being as articulate as you've just been about the dynamic. You know, it's interesting, the word academia comes from the Greek word meaning the oak forest that was outside of the walls of Athens. And you went to the oak forest, to the academia, to say subversive things that you could be killed for inside the walls of the polis. And so it was a place of freedom. And I do think that in many ways academia has actually become the polis itself. You know, it's become a place where it's very difficult, actually, to subvert the inherited reality. So one of the ways you could really kill a person's love of English literature is to put them through a university degree in the same subject.
Yes.
And there is a need, and it is happening, though. I mean, I'm being invited in. I'm a fellow at the Said Business School and Templeton College at Oxford. I'm being brought in as a poet to work alongside academics in their courses. I'm working with the Stanford MBA program, and so I think if you can bring a real precision and integrity to the outside perspective, then it will be received, and people will find a vehicle for it. So I do see it happening around the world, but it's something that there definitely needs to be more of, I would say.
Yeah. I have some encouragement. I talked to one person recently, and they said, well, just do it. If you do it in various different departments and nooks and crannies within the university framework, eventually it will be getting known that is something that's valuable, that the,
yeah,
the voting public and the state will start to support you.
Yes, and I think we're living in a time where everything needs to be put in conversation with everything else, that anything isolated becomes a travesty of itself. And it's only when you put things in conversation with everything else that the system becomes, and you could say, you know, becomes ecologically robust.
Right. We don't need everyone to be a generalist, but we need at least some people to be
civilized. Very good point.
Thanks very much.
All right.
Thank
We're
you.
Coming to the point. We have about 5 minutes left. I'm sitting here thinking that, just thinking about myself, my life, I certainly have a job that puts demands on me that can't be ignored, and that generally comes first. My relationship with my wife is very important, and I'm hoping that that's getting at least as much energy, maybe not quite. It seems for me, and this may be true for a lot of other people, though, that the thing that suffers, that's the distant third, is the third marriage. It's the one with myself.
Exactly, yes, and it's the most difficult because it needs a space. It needs silence. And as Wallace Stevens said, sometimes the truth depends upon a walk around the lake. So you've actually got to take yourself away from many of your outside commitments. And because our identity is so subsumed under busyness, it can actually feel as if stopping leads to a kind of dying. And especially if you get yourself into states of extreme stress and busyness, the act of stopping can seem like as if someone's actually pulling the respirator away from you, and part of you is dying. And I think the intuition is correct that you've got to, almost like practicing a musical instrument, spend increasingly more and more minutes of the day just by yourself, just going off for a little walk, just turning the radio off in the car, and trying to get as big a perspective as you can on the person you are and the particular threshold you're on in your life. And you have to get to know yourself again and again, just like you've got to get to know your spouse in a marriage again and again. And as soon as you stop getting to know them again and again, they become strangers to you because you're changing, they're changing. Well, in many ways, the person inside us is changing also and becoming someone new, someone who wants different things. And it's that closeness to that interior person that allows you to look at your work and say, you know, I need something slightly bigger. I need to reimagine what I'm doing. I need to bring in another thread, another dimension, or I need to go and do something completely different.
Yeah.
And so that third marriage is incredibly important. And as I say, it was the most elusive and the most difficult to follow in the book. I followed the life of an unknown Midwestern woman called Deirdre Blomfield Brown, who led a very fragile, meek early life, and then in later life became this incredible author and Tibetan teacher called Pema Chodron. And she went through those very difficult transitions and has written all of these very useful books, including one famous book called When Things Fall Apart. So I follow her discipline in a way, the discipline she followed in getting to know the self through this Tibetan tradition. Of course, it doesn't have to be a Tibetan tradition. It can be any religious tradition. It can be a contemplative tradition, or you can be an atheist who just spends a lot of time in silence and quiet, a silence and quiet which gives meaning and resonance to all of your actions in the world.
Mm. It strikes me that the one perhaps difference between these three things, one difference is that as far as your work is concerned, it pulls you in, whether you will or no. And I'm sure the same thing happens with your relationship with your partner. You get pulled in.
Yeah.
And that in the third case, it's a matter of having to, in a very deliberate way, decide that you're going to do this. That's a very
good distinction, actually. Yes.
And it does require some discipline, carving out of time, and that sometimes is maybe going to be the most difficult thing.
That's very good. As I think more into that, to what you just said, which I think is quite remarkable, I think that the willful entrance is more at the beginning, and then as you get more comfortable with the self, then it has its draw later on in the relationship. So perhaps, you know, the courtship part is reversed, actually. So you get once you've set up the original relationship through a kind of willful discipline of silence and space, then you start to get drawn in other words, in other ways later down the line.
Mm.
Yes.
Mm. We're just at the point, about the point we have to finish. What sort of thought would you like to leave with folks?
Well, I just think it's quite remarkable and ironic that I'm, as a poet, I'm being brought in by the engineering school.
I could have thought so too, actually. When I saw that, I thought, that's very interesting.
To talk on relationship. So I think that in itself is intriguing and it's representative of what I'm about. And even though the aegis they're bringing me in under, you know, which is work-life balance, which I'm actually trying to subvert, I think it's a very fruitful relationship. Once we put the logistical, empirical, strategic part of ourselves in conversation with the more imaginative and relation-based qualities of a human being. So that's what I'm hoping to put together that evening when I address the crowds. So.
Well, as I mentioned, our guest, David White, will be here visiting the campus. His visit is indeed sponsored by the College of Engineering. He'll be giving a talk at the Alumni Center, 5 in the afternoon on March 19th. It's open to anyone who is interested in hearing him. And also, in the meantime, if you'd like to look at his book, the title is The Three Marriages, Reimagining Work, Self, and Relationship, published by Riverhead Books. And again, if you go looking for the book, his last name is spelled W-H-Y-T-E, David White. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Thank you.